Letters That Have Helped Me by William Q. Judge. Volume 1. Letter 10. Dear Jasper, you ask me about the three qualities sprung from nature, mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita. They exist potentially, or latent, in Purush, or spirit, and during that time spoken of in the Bhagavad Gita as the time when he produces all things after having devoured them, which is the same thing as Saturn devouring his children, they come forth into activity, and therefore are found implicating all beings, who are said not to be free from their influence. Beings here must refer to formed beings in all worlds. Therefore in these forms the qualities exist. Note. For form is derived from nature equals prakriti equals cosmic substance. JN. End note. And at the same time implicate the spectator, or soul, who is in the form. The devas are gods, that is, a sort of spiritual power who are lower than the Ishvara in man. They are influenced by the quality of sattva, or truth. They enjoy a period of immense felicity of enormous duration, but which having duration is not an eternity. It is written, goodness, badness, and indifference, the qualities thus called, sprung from nature, influence the imperishable soul within the body. This imperishable soul is thus separated from the body in which the qualities influence it, and also from the qualities which are not it. It is Ishvara. The Ishvara is thus implicated by the qualities. The first or highest quality is sattva, which is in its nature pure and pleasant, and implicates Ishvara by connection with pleasant things and with knowledge. Thus even by dwelling in sattva the soul is implicated. The second quality is raja and causes action, it implicates the soul because it partakes of avidity and propensity, and causing actions thus implicates the soul. The third, tamo quality, is of the nature of indifference and is the deluder of all mortals. It is fed by ignorance. Here then, are two great opposers to the soul, ignorance and action. For action proceeding from raja assisted by sattva does not lead to the highest place, while ignorance causes destruction. Yet when one knows that he is ignorant, he has to perform actions in order to destroy that ignorance. How to do that without always revolving in the whirl of action? Note. Karma, causing rebirths. JN. End note. Is the question. He must first get rid of the idea that he himself really does anything, knowing that the actions all take place in these three natural qualities, and not in the soul at all. The word qualities must be considered in a larger sense than that word is generally given. Then he must place all his actions on devotion. That is, sacrifice all his actions to the Supreme and not to himself. He must either, leaving out indifference, set himself up as the God to whom he sacrifices, or the other real God, Krishna, and all his acts and aspirations are done either for himself or for the all. Here comes in the importance of motive. For if he performs great deeds of valor, or of benefit to man, or acquires knowledge so as to assist man, and is moved to that merely because he thinks he will attain salvation, he is only acting for his own benefit and is therefore sacrificing to himself. Therefore he must be devoted inwardly to the all, that is, he places all his actions on the Supreme, knowing that he is not the doer of the actions, but is the mere witness of them. As he is in a mortal body, he is affected by doubts which will spring up. When they do arise, it is because he is ignorant about something. He should therefore be able to disperse doubt by the sword of knowledge. For if he has a ready answer to some doubt, he disperses that much. All doubts come from the lower nature, and never in any case from higher nature. Therefore as he becomes more and more devoted he is able to know more and more clearly the knowledge residing in his sattva part. For it says, a man who, perfected in devotion, or who persists in its cultivation, finds spiritual knowledge spontaneously in himself in progress of time. Also, the man of doubtful mind enjoys neither this world nor the other, the Deva world, nor final beatitude. The last sentence is to destroy the idea that if there is in us this higher self it will, even if we are indolent and doubtful, triumph over the necessity for knowledge, and lead us to final beatitude in common with the whole stream of man. The three qualities are lower than a state called Turiya, which is a high state capable of being enjoyed even while in this body. Therefore in that state, there exists none of the three qualities, but there the soul sees the three qualities moving in the ocean of being beneath. This experience is not only met with after death, but as I said, it may be enjoyed in the present life, though of course consciously very seldom. But even consciously there are those high yogis who can and do rise up to nirvana, or spirit, while on the earth. This state is the fourth state, called Turiya. There is no word in English which will express it. In that state the body is alive though in deep catalepsy. Note. Self-induced by the adept. JN. End note. When the adept returns from it he brings back whatever he can of the vast experiences of that Turiya state. Of course they are far beyond any expression, and their possibilities can be only dimly perceived by us. I cannot give any description thereof because I have not known it, but I perceive the possibilities, and you probably can do the same. It is well to pursue some kind of practice, and pursue it either in a fixed place, or in a mental place which cannot be seen, or at night. The fact that what is called dharana, dhyana, and samadhi may be performed should be known. See Patanjali's Yoga System. Dharana is selecting a thing, a spot, or an idea, to fix the mind on. Dhyana is contemplation of it. Samadhi is meditating on it. When attempted, they of course are all one act. Now then, take what is called the well of the throat or pit of the throat. First. Select it. Dharana. Second. Hold the mind on it. Dhyana. Third. Meditate on it. Samadhi. This gives firmness of mind. Then select the spot in the head where the Sushumna nerve goes. Never mind the location, call it the top of the head. Then pursue the same course. This will give some insight into spiritual minds. At first it is difficult, but it will grow easy by practice. If done at all, the same hour of each day should be selected, as creating a habit, not only in the body, but also in the mind. Always keep the direction of Krishna in mind, namely, that it is done for the whole body corporate of humanity, and not for oneself. As regards the passions, anger seems to be the force of nature, there is more in it, though. Lust, so-called, is the gross symbol of love and desire to create. It is the perversion of the true in love and desire. Vanity, I think, represents in one aspect the illusion, power of nature, Maya, that which we mistake for the reality. It is nearest always to us and most insidious, just as nature's illusion is ever present and difficult to overcome. Anger and lust have some of the Rajasika quality, but it seems to me that vanity is almost wholly of the Tamogunam. May you cross over to the fearless shore. Z. Editor's note. As regards the practices of concentration suggested in this letter, they are only stages in a lifelong contemplation, they are means to an end, means of a certain order among means of other orders, all necessary, the highest path being that of constant devotion and entire resignation to the law. The above means have a physiological value because the spots suggested for contemplation are, like others, vital centers. Excitation of these centers, and of the magnetic residue of breath always found in them, strengthens and arouses the faculties of the inner man, the magnetic vehicle of the soul and the link between matter and spirit. This is a form of words necessary for clearness, because in reality matter and spirit are one. We may better imagine an infinite series of force correlations which extend from pure spirit to its grossest vehicle, and we may say that the magnetic inner vehicle, or astral man, stands at the halfway point of the scale. The secret of the circulation of the nervous fluid is hidden in these vital centers, and he who discovers it can use the body at will. Moreover, this practice trains the mind to remain in its own principle, without energizing, and without exercising its tangential force, which is so hard to overcome. Thought has a self-reproductive power, and when the mind is held steadily to one idea it becomes colored by it, and as we may say, all the correlates of that thought arise within the mind. Hence the mystic obtains knowledge about any object of which he thinks constantly in fixed contemplation. Here is the rationale of Krishna's words. Think constantly of me, depend on me alone, and thou shalt surely come unto me. The pure instincts of children often reveal occult truths. I heard a girl of 15 say recently, "When I was a small child I was always supposing. I used to sit on the window seat and stare, at the moon, and I was supposing that, if I only stared long enough, I'd get there and know all about it." Spiritual culture is attained through concentration. It must be continued daily and every moment to be of use. The Elixir of Life, 5 years of Theosophy, gives us some of the reasons for this truth. Meditation has been defined as the cessation of active, external thought. Concentration is the entire life tendency to a given end. For example, a devoted mother is one who consults the interests of her children and all branches of their interests in and before all things, not one who sits down to think fixedly about one branch of their interests all the day. Life is the great teacher, it is the great manifestation of soul, and soul manifests the supreme. Hence all methods are good, and all are but parts of the great aim, which is devotion. Devotion is success in actions, says the Bhagavad Gita. We must use higher and lower faculties alike, and beyond those of mind are those of the spirit, unknown but discoverable. The psychic powers, as they come, must also be used, for they reveal laws. But their value must not be exaggerated, nor must their danger be ignored. They are more subtle intoxicants than the gross physical energies. He who relies upon them is like a man who gives way to pride and triumph because he has reached the first wayside station on the peaks he has set out to climb. Like despondency, like doubt, like fear, like vanity, pride, and self-satisfaction, these powers too are used by nature as traps to detain us. Every occurrence, every object, every energy may be used for or against the great end. In each, nature strives to contain spirit, and spirit strives to be free. Shall the substance paralyze the motion, or shall the motion control the substance? The interrelations of these two is manifestation. The ratio of activity governs spiritual development. When the great force has gained its full momentum, it carries us to the borders of the unknown. It is a force intelligent, self-conscious, and spiritual. Its lower forms, or vehicles, or correlates may be evoked by us, but itself comes only of its own volition. We can only prepare a vehicle for it, in which, as Bayman says, the Holy Ghost may ride in its own chariot. Quote, "The self cannot be known by the Vedas, nor by the understanding, nor by much learning. He whom the self chooses, by him alone the self can be gained. The self chooses him as his own. But the man who has not first turned aside from his wickedness, who is not calm and subdued, or whose mind is not at rest, he can never obtain the self, even by knowledge." End quote. The italics are mine. They indicate the value of that stage of contemplation hitherto referred to as that in which the mind has ceased to energize, and when the pure energies of nature go to swell the fountain of spirit. In regard to the phrase in the above letter that the adept brings back what he can from Turiya, it is to be understood as referring to the fact that all depends upon the coordination of the various principles in man. He who has attained perfection or Mahatmaship has assumed complete control of the body and informs it at will. But of course, while in the body he is still, to some extent, as a soul of power, limited by that body or vehicle. That is to say, there are experiences not to be shared by that organ of the soul called by us the body, and beyond a certain point its brain cannot reflect or recall them. The point varies according to the degree of attainment of individual souls, and while in some it may be a high point of great knowledge and power, still it must be considered as limited compared with those spiritual experiences of the freed soul. The work upon which all disciples are employed is that of rendering the body more porous, more fluidic, more responsive to all spiritual influences which arise in the inner center, in the soul which is an undivided part of the great soul of all, and less receptive of the outside material influences which are generated by the unthinking world and by those qualities which are in nature. Abstract thought is said to be the power of thinking of a thing apart from its qualities, but these qualities are the phenomenal, the evident, and they make the most impression upon our senses. They bewilder us, and they form a part of that trap which nature sets for us lest we discover her inmost secret and rule her. More than this, our detention as individual components of a race provides time for that and other races to go through evolutionary experience slowly, provides long and repeated chances for every soul to amend, to return, to round the curve of evolution. In this nature is most merciful, and even in the darkness of the eighth sphere to which souls of spiritual wickedness descend, her impulses provide opportunities of return if a single responsive energy is left in the self-condemned soul. Many persons insist upon a perfect moral code tempered by social amenities, forgetting that these vary with climate, nationalities, and dates. Virtue is a noble offering to the Lord. But in so much as it is mere bodily uprightness and mere mental uprightness, it is insufficient and stands apart from uprightness of the psychic nature or the virtue of soul. The virtue of the soul is true being, its virtue is, to be free. The body and the mind are not sharers in such experiences, though they may afterward reflect them, and this reflection may inform them with light and power of their own kind. Spirituality is not virtue. It is impersonality, in one aspect. It is as possible to be spiritually wicked as to be spiritually good. These attributes are only conferred upon spirituality by reason of its use for or against the great evolutionary law, which must finally prevail because it is the law of the deity, an expression of the nature and being of the unknown, which nature is towards manifestation, self-realization, and reabsorption. All that clashes with this law by striving for separate existence must in the long run fail, and any differentiation which is in itself incapable of reabsorption is reduced to its original elements, in which shape, so to say, it can be reabsorbed. Spirituality is then a condition of being which is beyond expression in language. Call it a rate of vibration, far beyond our cognizance. Its language is the language of motion, in its incipiency, and its perfection is beyond words and even thought. Quote, the knowledge of the supreme principle is a divine silence, and the quiescence of all the senses. Clavis of Hermes. End quote. Quote, likes and dislikes, good and evil, do not in the least affect the knower of Brahm, who is bodiless and always existing. Crest jewel of wisdom. End quote. Quote, of that nature which is beyond intellect many things are asserted according to intellection, but it is contemplated by a cessation of intellectual energy better than with it. Porphylios. End quote. Thought is bounded, and we seek to enter the boundless. The intellect is the first production of nature which energizes for the experience of the soul, as I said. When we recognize this truth we make use of that natural energy called thought for comparison, instruction, and the removal of doubt, and so reach a point where we restrain the outward tendencies of nature, for, when these are resolved into their cause and nature is wholly conquered and restrained, that cause manifests itself both in and beyond nature. Quote, the incorporeal substances in descending are divided and multiplied about individuals with a diminution of power, but when they ascend by their energies beyond bodies, they become united and exist as a whole by and through exuberance of power. Porphylios. End quote. These hints may suffice for such minds as are already upon the way. Others will be closed to them. Language only expresses the experiences of a race, and since ours has not reached the upper levels of being we have as yet no words for these things. The East has ever been the home of spiritual research, she has given all the great religions to the world. The Sanskrit has thus terms for some of these states and conditions, but even in the East it is well understood that the formless cannot be expressed by form, or the illimitable by the limits of words or signs. The only way to know these states is to be them. We never can really know anything which we are not. J.N. End Editor's Note. Letter 11. It has been with regret that I hear of your serious illness, Jasper. While life hangs in the balance, as it would seem yours does and for some time will, you will feel much depression. Now it is not usual to thus calmly talk to a person of his death, but you do not mind, so I talk. I do not agree with you that death is well. Yours is not a case like that of, unnamed, who was to die and decided to accept life from great powers and work on for humanity amid all the throes and anguish of that body. Why should you not live now as long as you can in the present body, so that in it you may make all the advance possible and by your life do as much good as you can to the cause and man? For you have not yet as Jasper Niemund had a chance to entitle you to extraordinary help after death in getting back again soon, so that you would die and run the chance of a long Davichen and miss much that you might do for them. Such are my views. Life is better than death, for death again disappoints the self. Death is not the great informer or producer of knowledge. It is only the great curtain on the stage to be rung up next instant. Complete knowledge must be attained in the triune man, body, soul, and spirit. When that is obtained, then he passes on to other spheres, which to us are unknown and are endless. By living as long as one can, one gives the self that longer chance. Atmanamatmanapushya, raise the self by the self, Gita, does not seem to be effective after the threshold of death is passed. The union of the Trinity is only to be accomplished on earth in a body, and then release is desirable. It is not for myself that I speak, brother, but for thee, because in death I can lose no one. The living have a greater part in the dead than the dead have in the living. The doubt which you now feel as to success is morbid. Please destroy it. Better a false hope with no doubt, than much knowledge with doubts of your own chances. He that doubteth is like the waves of the sea, driven by the wind and tossed. Doubt is not to be solely guarded against when applied to masters, whom I know you doubt not. It is most to be guarded and repelled in relation to oneself. Any idea that one cannot succeed, or had better die than live because an injured body seems to make success unattainable, is doubt. We dare not hope, but we dare try to live on and on that we may serve them as they serve the law. We are not to try to be chelas or to do any one thing in this incarnation, but only to know and to be just as much as we can, and the possibility is not measured. Reflect then, that it is only a question of being overcome. By what? By something outside. But if you accuse or doubt yourself, you then give the enemy a rest, he has nothing to do, for you do it all yourself for him, and leaving you to your fate, he seeks other victims. Rise then, from this despondency and seize the sword of knowledge. With it, and with love, the universe is conquerable. Not that I see thee too despondent, Jasper, but I fain would give thee my ideas, even did something kill thee against our will next day. I am glad that although the body is painful, you yourself are all right. We have in various ways to suffer, and I do not doubt it is a great advance if we can in the midst of physical suffering grasp and hold ourselves calm and away from it. Yet also the body must be rested. Rest, and let the anxieties to do lie still and dormant. By that they are not killed, and when the body gets stronger more is known. You have been in storms enough. A few moments' reflection will show you that we make our own storms. The power of any and all circumstances is a fixed, unvarying quality, but as we vary in our reception of these, it appears to us that our difficulties vary in intensity. They do not at all. We are the variants. If we admit that we are in the stream of evolution, then each circumstance must be to us quite right. And in our failures to perform set acts should be our greatest helps, for we can in no other way learn that calmness which Krishna insists upon. If all our plans succeeded, then no contrasts would appear to us. Also those plans we make may all be made ignorantly and thus wrongly, and kind nature will not permit us to carry them out. We get no blame for the plan, but we may acquire karmic demerit by not accepting the impossibility of achieving. Ignorance of the law cannot be pleaded among men, but ignorance of fact may. In occultism, even if you are ignorant of some facts of importance, you are not passed over by the law, for it has regard for no man, and pursues its adjustments without regard to what we know or are ignorant of. If you are at all cast down, or if any of us is, then by just that much are our thoughts lessened in power. One could be confined in a prison and yet be a worker for the cause. So I pray you to remove from your mind any distaste for present circumstances. If you can succeed in looking at it all as just what you in fact desired, then it will act not only as a strengthener of your good thoughts, but will reflexly act on your body and make it stronger. All this reminds me of H, of whose failure you now know. And in this be not disappointed. It could hardly be otherwise. Unwisely he made his demands upon the law before being quite ready. That is, unwisely in certain senses, for in the greater view naught can be unwise. His apparent defeat, at the very beginning of the battle, is for him quite of course. He went where the fire is hottest and made it hotter by his aspirations. All others have and all will suffer the same. For it makes no difference that his is a bodily affection, as all these things proceed from mental disturbances, we can easily see the same cause under a physical ailment as under a mental divagation. Strangely, too, I wrote you of the few who really do stay, and soon after this news came and threw a light, a red one, so to say, upon the information of H. his retreat. See how thought interlinks with thought on all planes when the true is the aim. We ourselves are not wholly exempt, inasmuch as we daily and hourly feel the strain. Accept the words of a fellow traveler, these: keep up the aspiration and the search, but do not maintain the attitude of despair or the slightest repining. Not that you do. I cannot find the right words, but surely you would know all, were it not that some defects hold you back. The darkness and the desolation are sure to be ours, but it is only illusionary. Is not the self pure, bright, bodiless, and free? And art thou not that? The daily waking life is but a penance and the trial of the body, so that it too may thereby acquire the right condition. In dreams we see the truth and taste the joys of heaven. In waking life it is ours to gradually distill that dew into our normal consciousness. Then, too, remember that the influences of this present age are powerful for producing these feelings. What despair and agony of doubt exist today in all places. In this time of upturning, the wise man waits. He bends himself, like the reed, to the blast, so that it may blow over his head. Rising, as you do, into the plain where these currents are rushing while you try to travel higher still, you feel these inimical influences, although unknown to you. It is an age of iron. A forest of iron trees, black and forbidding, with branches of iron and brilliant leaves of steel. The winds blow through its arches and we hear a dreadful grinding and crashing sound that silences the still small voice of love. And its inhabitants mistake this for the voice of God, they imitate it and add to its terrors. Faint not, be not self-condemned. We both are that soundless ohm, we rest together upon the bosom of Master. You are not tired, it is that body, now weak, and not only weak but shaken by the force of your own powers, physical and psychical. But the wise man learns to assume in the body an attitude of carelessness that is more careful really than any other. Let that be yours. You are judge. Who accepts you, who dares judge but yourself? Let us wait then, for natural changes, knowing that if the eye is fixed where the light shines, we shall presently know what to do. This hour is not ripe. But unripe fruit gets ripe, and falls or is plucked. The day must surely strike when you will pluck it down. You are no longer troubled by vain fears or compromises. When the great thought comes near enough, you will go. We must all be servants before we can hope to be masters in the least. I have been rereading the life of Buddha, and it fills me with a longing desire to give myself for humanity, to devote myself to a fierce, determined effort to plant myself near the altar of sacrifice. As I do not always know just what ought to be done, I must stand on what Master says. Do what you can, if you ever expect to see them. This being true, and another adept saying, follow the path they and I show, but do not follow my path, why then, all we can do, whether great or small, is to do just what we can, each in his proper place. It is sure that if we have an immense devotion and do our best, the result will be right for them and us, even though we would have done otherwise had we known more when we were standing on a course of action. A devoted chela once said, "I do not mind all these efforts at explanation and all this trouble, for I always have found that that which was done in Master's name was right and came out right. What is done in those names is done without thought of self, and motive is the essential test. So I am sad and not sad. Not sad when I reflect on the great Ishvar, the Lord, permitting all these antics and shows before our eyes. Sad when I see our weakness and disabilities. We must be serene and do what we can." Ramasvamir rushed off into Sikkim to try and find Master, and met someone who told him to go back and do his duty. "That is all any of us can do. Often we do not know our duty, but that too is our own fault, it is a karmic disability. You ask me how you shall advise your fellow student. The best advice is found in your own letter to me, in which you say that the true monitor is within." "That is so. 10,000 adepts can do one no great good unless we ourselves are ready, and they only act as suggestors to us of what possibilities there are in every human heart. If we dwell within ourselves, and must live and die by ourselves, it must follow that running here and there to see anything or person does not in itself give progress. Mind, I do not oppose consorting with those who read holy books and are engaged in dwelling on high themes. I am only trying to illustrate my idea that this should not be dwelt on as an end, it is only a means and one of many. There is no help like association with those who think as we do, or like the reading of good books. The best advice I ever saw was to read holy books or whatever books tend to elevate yourself, as you have found by experience. There must be some. Once I found some abstruse theological writings of Plotinus to have that effect on me, very ennobling, and also an explanation of the wanderings of Ulysses. Then there is the Gita. All these are instinct with a life of their own which changes the vibrations. Vibration is the key to it all. The different states are only differences of vibration, and we do not recognize the astral or other planes because we are out of tune with their vibrations. This is why we now and then dimly feel that others are peering at us, or as if a host of people rushed by us with great things on hand, not seeing us and we not seeing them. It was an instant of synchronous vibration. But the important thing is to develop the self in the self, and then the possessions of wisdom belonging to all wise men at once belong to us. Each one would see the self differently and would yet never see it, for to see it is to be it. But for making words we say, see it. It might be a flash, a blazing wheel, or what not. Then there is the lower self, great in its way, and which must first be known. When first we see it, it is like looking into a glove, and for how many incarnations may it not be so? We look inside the glove and there is darkness, then we have to go inside and see that, and so on and on. The mystery of the ages is man, each one of us. Patience is needed in order that the passage of time required for the bodily instrument to be altered or controlled is complete. Violent control is not as good as gentle control, continuous and firmly unrelaxed. The seeress of Prevorst found that a gentle current did her more good than a violent one would. Gentleness is better because an opposition current is always provoked, and of course if that which produces it is gentle, it will also be the same. This gives the unaccustomed student more time and gradual strength. I think your fellow student will be a good instrument, but we must not break the silence of the future lest we raise up unknown and difficult tribes who will not be easy to deal with. Every situation ought to be used as a means. This is better than philosophy, for it enables us to know philosophy. You do not progress by studying other people's philosophies, for then you do but get their crude ideas. Do not crowd yourself, nor ache to puzzle your brains with another's notions. You have the key to self and that is all, take it and drag out the lurker inside. You are great in generosity and love, strong in faith, and straight in perception. Generosity and love are the abandonment of self. That is your staff. Increase your confidence, not in your abilities, but in the great all being thyself. I would to God you and all the rest might find peace. Z. Letter 12. Dear Jasper. There are so many questioners who ask about chelaship. Note. Chela means disciple. It is a Sanskrit word. JN. End note. That your letter comes quite apropos to experiences of my own. You say that these applicants must have some answer, and in that I agree with you. And whether they are ready or unready, we must be able to tell them something. But generally they are not ready, nor, indeed, are they willing to take the first simple step which is demanded. I will talk the matter over with you for your future guidance in replying to such questions, perhaps also to clear up my own mind. The first question a man should ask himself, and by man we mean postulants of either sex, is, when and how did I get a desire to know about chelaship and to become a chela? And secondly, what is a chela, and what chelaship? There are many sorts of chelas. There are lay chelas and probationary ones, accepted chelas and those who are trying to fit themselves to be even lay chelas. Any person can constitute himself a lay chela, feeling sure that he may never in this life consciously hear from his guide. Then as to probationary chelas, there is an invariable rule that they go upon 7 years trial. These trials do not refer to fixed and stated tests, but to all the events of life and the bearing of the probationer in them. There is no place to which applicants can be referred where their request could be made, because these matters do not relate to places and to officials. This is an affair of the inner nature. We become chelas, we obtain that position in reality because our inner nature is to that extent opened that it can and will take knowledge. We receive the guerdon at the hands of the law. In a certain sense every sincere member of the Theosophical Society is in the way of becoming a chela, because the masters do some of their work with and for humanity through this society, selected by them as their agent. And as all their work and aspiration are to the end of helping the race, no one of their chelas can hope to remain, or become, such, if any selfish desire for personal possessions of spiritual wealth constitutes the motive for trying to be a chela. Such a motive, in the case of one already a chela, acts instantly to throw him out of the ranks, whether he be aware of his loss or not, and in the case of one trying to become a chela it acts as a bar. Nor does a real chela spread the fact that he is such. For this lodge is not like exoteric societies which depend upon favor or mere outward appearances. It is a real thing with living spirit, men at its head, governed by laws that contain within themselves their own executioners, and that do not require a tribunal, nor accusations, nor verdicts, nor any notice whatever. As a general thing a person of European or American birth has extreme difficulty to contend with. He has no heredity of psychical development to call upon, no known assembly of masters or their chelas within reach. His racial difficulties prevent him from easily seeing within himself, he is not introspective by nature. But even he can do much if he purifies his motive, and either naturally possesses or cultivates an ardent and unshakable faith and devotion. A faith that keeps him a firm believer in the existence of masters even through years of non-intercourse. They are generous and honest debtors and always repay. How they repay, and when, is not for us to ask. Men may say that this requires as blind devotion as was ever asked by any church. It does, but it is a blind devotion to masters who are truth itself, to humanity and to yourself, to your own intuitions and ideals. This devotion to an ideal is also founded upon another thing, and that is that a man is hardly ready to be a chela unless he is able to stand alone and uninfluenced by other men or events, for he must stand alone, and he might as well know this at the beginning as at the end. There are also certain qualifications which he must possess. These are to be found in man. Fragments of forgotten history towards the close of the book, so we will not dwell upon them here. The question of the general fitness of applicants being disposed of, we come to the still more serious point of the relations of guru and chela, or master and disciple. We want to know what it really is to be a pupil of such a teacher. The relation of guru and chela is nothing if it is not a spiritual one. Whatever is merely outward, or formal, as the relation established by mere asking and acceptance, is not spiritual, but formal, and is that which arises between teacher and pupil. Yet even this latter is not in any way despicable, because the teacher stands to his pupil, in so far forth as the relation permits, in the same way as the guru to his chela. It is a difference of degree, but this difference of degree is what constitutes the distinction between the spiritual and the material. 4. Passing along the different shadings from the grossest materiality to as far as we can go, we find at last that matter merges into spirit. We are now speaking, of course, about what is commonly called matter, while we well know that in truth the thing thus designated is not really matter, but an enormous illusion which in itself has no existence. The real matter, called Mula Prakriti by the Hindus, is an invisible thing or substance of which our matter is a representation. The real matter is what the Hermetists called primordial earth, a, for us, intangible phase of matter. We can easily come to believe that what is usually called matter is not really such, inasmuch as we find clairvoyants and nervous people seeing through thick walls and closed doors. Were this matter, then they could not see through it. But when an ordinary clairvoyant comes face to face with primordial matter, he or she cannot see beyond, but is met by a dead wall more dense than any wall ever built by human hands. So from earliest times, among all but the modern Western people, the teacher was given great reverence by the pupil, and the latter was taught from youth to look upon his preceptor as only second to his father and mother in dignity. It was among these people a great sin, a thing that did one actual harm in his moral being, to be disrespectful to his teacher even in thought. The reason for this lay then, and no less today does also lie, in the fact that a long chain of influence extends from the highest spiritual guide who may belong to any man, down through vast numbers of spiritual chiefs, ending at last even in the mere teacher of our youth. Or, to restate it in modern reversion of thought, a chain extends up from our teacher or preceptors to the highest spiritual chief in whose ray or descending line one may happen to be. And it makes no difference whatever, in this occult relation, that neither pupil nor final guide may be aware, or admit, that this is the case. Thus it happens that the child who holds his teacher in reverence and diligently applies himself accordingly with faith, does no violence to this intangible but mighty chain, and is benefited accordingly, whether he knows it or not. Nor again does it matter that a child has a teacher who evidently gives him a bad system. This is his karma, and by his reverent and diligent attitude he works it out, and transcends erstwhile that teacher. This chain of influence is called the Guru Parampara chain. The Guru is the guide or readjuster, and may not always combine the function of teacher with it. Z. Letter 13. Dear Jasper, we now have passed from the mere usual and worldly relations of teacher and pupil to that which we will call the lodge for the nonce. This lodge is not to be taken up in the pincers of criticism and analyzed or fixed. It is at once everywhere and nowhere. It contains within its boundaries all real masters, students, guides, and gurus, of whatever race or creed or no creed. Of it has been said, quote, "Beyond the hall of learning is the lodge. It is the whole body of sages in all the world. It cannot be described even by those who are in it, but the student is not prohibited from imagining what it is like." End quote. So therefore at any time any one of its real teachers or disciples will gladly help any other teacher or disciple. But we are not to conclude that, because all are trying to spread truth and to teach the world, we, who call ourselves chela aspirants or known chelas of any certain person whom we call guru, can place ourselves at the same moment under the direct tutelage of more than one guru. Each man who determines in himself that he will enter the path, has a guru. But the time between that determination and the hour when he will really know the master may be long indeed, in some cases it is very short. We must now occupy a moment in some consideration of divisions. Just as the merest private in the army has a general who guides the whole but whom he cannot reach except through the others who are officers, so in this order we find divisions of gurus as well as divisions of disciples. There is the great guru, who is such to many who never know him or see him. Then there are others who know him, and who are gurus to a number of chelas, and so on until we may imagine a chela who may be a known guru to another chela below him. Then, again, there may be chelas who are acting as guru, unacknowledged, because pro tempore in function, to one or more other chelas. Now he who makes the resolution above mentioned, does thereby make a bond that rests in the highest law. It is not a thing to be lightly done, because its consequences are of a serious nature. Not serious in the way of disasters or awful torments or such, but serious in respect to the clearness and brilliancy of those rays of truth which we wish to reach us. We have thereby, in a sense, its degree determined by the sincerity and power of our motive, taken ourselves out of the common, vast, moving herd of men who are living, as to this, like dumb animals, and have knocked at a door. If we have reverenced our teacher, we will now revere our unknown guru. We must stand interiorly in a faithful attitude. We must have an abiding, settled faith that nothing may shake. For it is to mighty karma we have appealed, and as the guru is karma in the sense that he never acts against karma, we must not lose faith for an instant. For it is this faith that clears up the air there, and that enables us to get help from all quarters. Then perhaps this determinant or postulant or neophyte decides for himself that he will for the time take as teacher or guide some other chela whose teachings commend themselves. It is not necessary that any outspoken words should pass between these two. But having done this, even in thought, he should then apply himself diligently to the doctrine of that teacher, not changing until he really finds he has another teacher or has gone to another class. For if he takes up one merely to dispute and disagree, whether outwardly or mentally, he is thereby in danger of totally obscuring his own mind. If he finds himself not clearly understanding, then he should with faith try to understand, for if he by love and faith vibrates into the higher meaning of his teacher, his mind is thereby raised, and thus greater progress is gained. We now come to the possible case of an aspirant of that royal and kingly faith who in some way has really found a person who has advanced far upon the path. To this person he has applied and said, "May I be accepted, and may I be a chela of either thee or some other." That person applied to then perhaps says, "Not to me, but I refer you to some other of the same class as yourself, and give you to him to be his chela. Serve him." With this the aspirant goes, say to the one designated, and deliberately both agree to it. Here is a case where the real master has recommended the aspirant to a co-worker who perchance is some grade higher than our neophyte, and the latter is now in a different position from the many others who are silently striving and working, and learning from any and all teachers, but having no specialized guru for themselves. This neophyte and his little guru are connected by a clear and sacred bond, or else both are mere lying children, playing and unworthy of attention. If the little guru is true to his trust, he occupies his mind and heart with it, and is to consider that the chela represents humanity to him for the time. We postulated that this little guru was in advance of the chela. It must then happen that he says that which is sometimes not clear to his chela. This will all the more be so if his chela is new to the matter. But the chela has deliberately taken that guru, and must try to understand the doctrine of that teacher. The proper function of the guru is to readjust, and not to pour in vast masses of knowledge expressed in clear and easily comprehended terms. The latter would be a piece of nonsense, however agreeable, and not any whit above what any well-written book would do for its reader. The faith and love which exist between them act as a stimulus to both, and as a purifier to the mind of the chela. But if the chela, after a while, meets another person who seems to know as much as his little guru, and to express it in very easy terms, and the chela determines to take him as a teacher, he commits an error. He may listen to his teaching and admire and profit by it, but the moment he mentally determines and then in words asks the other to be his teacher, he begins to rupture the bond that was just established, and possibly may lose altogether the benefit of both. Not necessarily, however, but certainly, if he acquaints not his little guru with the fact of the new adoption of teacher, there will be much confusion in that realm of being wherein both do their real work, and when he does acquaint his little guru with the fact of the newly acquired teacher, that older guru will retire. None of this is meant for those minds which do not regard these matters as sacred. A guru is a sacred being in that sense. Not, of course, in a general sense, yet even if so regarded when worthy it is better for the chela, but in all that pertains to the spiritual and real life. To the high-strung soul this is a matter of adoption, a most sacred and valuable thing, not lightly taken up or lightly dropped. For the Guru becomes for the time the spiritual father of the Chela, that one who is destined to bring him into life or to pass him on to him who will do so. So as the Guru is the adjuster in reality, the Chela does not, except where the Guru is known to be a great sage or where the Chela does it by nature, give slavish attention to every word. He hears the word and endeavors to assimilate the meaning underneath, and if he cannot understand he lays it aside for a better time, while he presently endeavors to understand what he can. And if even, as is often so in India, he cannot understand at all, he is satisfied to be near the Guru and do what may properly be done for him, for even then his abiding faith will eventually clear his mind, of which there are many examples, and regarding which how appropriate is the line. They also serve who only stand and wait. Z. Letter 14. Dear Jasper. What I wrote in my last is what may be properly said to earnest inquirers who show by their perseverance that they are not mere idle curiosity seekers, desirous of beguiling the tedium of life with new experiments and sensations. It is not what is done, but the spirit in which the least thing is done for them, who are all, that is counted. You ask the names of the seven rays or lodges. The names could not be given if known to me. In these matters names are always realities, and consequently to give the name would be to reveal the thing itself. Besides, if the names were given, the ordinary person hearing them would not understand them. Just as if I should say that the name of the first is X, which expresses nothing at all to the mind of the hearing person. All that can be said is that there exist those seven rays, districts, or divisions, just as we say that in a town there are legislators, merchants, teachers, and servants. The difference is that in this case we know all about the town, and know just what those names mean. The name only directs the mind to the idea or essential quality. Again I must go. But brothers are never parted while they live for the true alone. Z. Editor's note. The foregoing letters point clearly to one conclusion concerning that great theosophist, Madame Blavatsky, though she is unnamed and perhaps unthought of there. Since she sacrificed, not so calling it herself, all that mankind holds dear to bring the glad tidings of theosophy to the West, that West, and especially the Theosophical Society, thereby stands to her as a chela to his guru, in so far as it accepts theosophy. Her relation to these theosophists has its being in the highest law, and cannot be expunged or ignored. So those who regard her personality, and finding it discordant from theirs, try to reach the masters by other means while disregarding or underrating scornfully her high services, violate a rule which, because it is not made of man, cannot be broken with impunity. Gratitude and the common sentiment of man for man should have taught them this, without occult teaching at all. Such persons have not reached that stage of evolution where they can learn the higher truths. She who accepts the pains of the rack in the torments of a body sapped of its life force by superb torrents of energy lavished on her high cause. She who has braved the laughter and anger of two continents, and all the hosts of darkness seen and unseen. She who now lives on, only that she may take to herself the karma of the society and so ensure its well-being, has no need of any man's praise, but even she has need of justice, because, without that impulse in our hearts and souls toward her, she knows that we must fail for this incarnation. As the babe to the mother, as harvest to the earth, so are all those bound to her who enjoy the fruit of her life. May we try then, to understand these occult connections brought about by the workings of karma, and bring them to bear upon our diurnal, as well as our theosophical, life. Madame Blavatsky is for us the next higher link in that great chain, of which no link can be passed over or missed. In further illustration of this letter, I might cite the case of a friend of mine who was at once fired with theosophy on first hearing of it and ardently desired to become a chela. Certainly he had known these truths in other lives, for all seemed familiar to him, and though he was what is called a man of the world, he accepted the philosophy, measured some of its possibilities intuitively, and while careful to do his duty and cause no jars, he ranged his life, especially his inner life, to suit these views. The question of chelaship assumed great prominence in his mind. He knew of no chelas, knew not where to knock or whom to ask. Reflection convinced him that real chalaship consisted in the inner attitude of the postulant. He remembered magnetic and energic laws, and he said to himself that he could at will constitute himself a chala to the law, at least so far as his own attitude went, and if this did not satisfy him, it was a proof that he desired some personal reward, satisfaction, or powers in the matter, and that his motive was not pure. He was slow to formulate his desires, even to his own mind, for he would not lightly make demands upon the law, but he at last determined to put his own motives to the test, to try himself and see if he could stand in the attitude of a faithful chela, unrecognized and apparently unheard. He then recorded in his own mind an obligation to serve truth and the law as a chela should, always seeking for light and for further aid if possible, recognizing meanwhile that the obligation was on his side only, and that he had no claims on masters, and only such as he himself could by the strength of his own purpose institute upon the law. Wherever he could hear of chelas and their duties he listened or read, he tried to imagine himself in the position of an accepted chela, and to fill, so far as in him lay, the duties of that place, living up to all the light he had. For he held that a disciple should always think and act towards the highest possibilities, whether or not he had yet attained these, and not merely confine himself to that course of action which might be considered suited to his lower class or spiritual estate. He believed that the heart is the creator of all real ties, and it alone. To raise himself by himself was then his task. This attitude he resolved to maintain life after life, if needs were, until at last his birthright should be assured, his claim recognized by the law. He met with trials, with coldness from those who felt rather than saw his changed attitude, he met with all the nameless shocks that others meet when they turn against the whirlpool of existence and try to find their way back into the true currents of life. Great sorrows and loneliness were not slow to challenge his indomitable will. But he found work to do, and in this he was most fortunate, for to work for others is the disciple's joy, his share in the divine life, his first accolade by which he may know that his service is accepted. This man had called upon the law in faith supreme, and he was answered. Karma sent him a friend, and soon he began to get new knowledge, and after a time information reached him of a place or person where he might apply to become a chela on probation. It was not given him as information usually is, nothing of the sort was told him, but with his extending knowledge and opening faculties a conviction dawned upon him that he might pursue such and such a course. He did so, and his prayer was heard. He said to me afterwards that he never knew whether he would not have shown greater strength of mind by relying wholly upon the reality of his unseen, unacknowledged claim, until the moment should come when masters should accept and call him. For of course he held the ideal of masters clearly before his mind all this while. Perhaps his application showed him to be weaker than he supposed, in so far as it might evidence a need on his part for tangible proof of a fact in which his higher nature prompted him to believe without such proof. Perhaps it was but natural and right on the other hand, that after silent service for some time he should put himself on record at the first opportunity granted him by karma. He applied, then. I am permitted to give a portion of the answer he received, and which made clear to him the fact that he was already accepted in some measure before his application, as his intuition had told him. The answer may be of untold value to others, both as clearly setting forth the dangers of forcing one's way ahead of one's race, and also by its advice, admonitions, and evidence that the great beings of the Orient deal most frankly and gently with applicants. Also it may mark out a course for those who take the wise plan of testing themselves in silence before pushing their demands upon the law. For this at once heightens their magnetic vibrations, their evolutionary ratio, their flame burns more brilliantly and attracts all kinds of shapes and influences within its radius, so that the fire is hot about him. And not for him alone. Other lives coming in contact with his feel this fierce energy, they develop more rapidly. And if they have a false or weak place in their nature, it is soon discovered and overthrows them for a time. This is the danger of coming into the circle of ascetics. A man must be strong indeed who thus thrusts himself in. It is better as a rule to place oneself in the attitude of a disciple and impose the tests oneself. Less opposition is provoked. For forces that are foiled by the adept may hurl themselves on the neophyte who cannot be protected unless his karma permits it, and there are always those opposing forces of darkness waiting to thin the ranks of the servitors of the good law. Up to this point then, we may follow this student, and then we lose sight of him, not knowing whether he progressed or failed, or still serves and waits, because such things are not made known. To tell so much as this is rare, and since it is permitted, it must be because there are many earnest students in this country who need some such support and information. To these I can say that, if they constitute themselves faithful, unselfish disciples, they are such in the knowledge of the great law, so long as they are true, in inmost thought and smallest deed, to the pledges of their heart. Answer to why, says Master. Start of shared letter. Quote, is why fully prepared for the uphill work? The way to the goal he strives to reach is full of thorns and leads through miry quagmires. Many are the sufferings the chela has to encounter, still more numerous the dangers to face and conquer. May he think over it and choose only after due reflection. No master appealed to by a sincere soul who thirsts for light and knowledge, has ever turned his face away from the supplicant. But it is the duty of those who call for laborers and need them for their fields, to point out to those who offer themselves in truth and trust for the arduous work, the pitfalls in the soil as the hardship of the task. If undaunted by this warning, why persists in his determination, he may regard himself as accepted as unnamed. Let him place himself in such case under the guidance of an older chela. By helping him sincerely and devotedly to carry on his heavy burden, he shall prepare the way for being helped in his turn. End quote. Here follow private instructions. Resume quote. Verily, if the candidate relies upon the law, if he has patience, trust, and intuition, he will not have to wait too long. Through the great shadow of bitterness and sorrow that the opposing powers delight in throwing over the pilgrim on his way to the gates of light, the candidate perceives that shining light very soon in his own soul, and he has but to follow it. Let him beware, however, lest he mistake the occasional will-o'-the-wisp of the psychic senses for the reflex of the great spiritual light, that light which dieth not, yet never lives, nor can it shine elsewhere than on the pure mirror of spirit. But why has to use his own intuitions? One has to dissipate and conquer the inner darkness before attempting to see into the darkness without, to know oneself before knowing things extraneous to one's senses. End quote. And now, may the powers to which my friend Y has appealed be permitted by still greater and much higher powers to help him. This is the sincere and earnest wish of his truly and fraternally. Triangle diagram. End shared letter. This letter also shows incidentally how one adept may serve another still higher by reporting or conveying his reply. The following is an article from The Path, July 1888 by W. Q. Judge. To aspirants for chelaship. Sincere interest in theosophic truth is often followed by sincere aspiration after theosophic life, and the question continually recurs, what are the conditions and the steps to chelaship? To whom should application be made? How is the aspirant to know that it has been granted? As to the conditions and the discipline of chelaship, not a little has been disclosed in the Theosophist, Man, Esoteric Buddhism, and other works upon theosophy, and some of the qualifications, difficulties, and dangers have been very explicitly set forth by Madame Blavatsky in her article upon Theosophical Mahatmas in The Path of December, 1886. To everyone cherishing even a vague desire for closer relations to the system of development through which masters are produced, the thoughtful study of this article is earnestly commended. It will clear the ground of several misconceptions, deepen the sense of the seriousness of such an effort, and excite a healthy self-distrust which is better before than after the gate has been passed. It is entirely possible, however, that the searching of desire and strength incited by that article may only convince more strongly of sincerity, and that not a few readers may emerge from it with a richer purpose and a deeper resolve. Even where there is not a distinct intention to reach chelaship, there may be an eager yearning for greater nearness to the masters, for some definite assurance of guidance and of help. In either of these cases, the question at once arises before the aspirant, who is to receive the application, and how is its acceptance to be signified? The very natural, indeed the instinctive, step of such an aspirant is to write to an officer of the Theosophical Society. Nonetheless, is this a mistake? For the Theosophical Society is an exoteric body, the Lodge of Masters wholly esoteric. The former is a voluntary group of inquirers and philanthropists, with avowed aims, a printed constitution, and published officers, and moreover, expressly disavowing any power, as a society, to communicate with masters. The latter is an occult lodge, of whose address, members, processes, functions, nothing is known. It follows therefore, that there is no person, no place, no address, to which an aspirant may appeal. Let it be supposed, however, that such an inquiry is proffered to a person advanced in occult study, versed in its methods and tests and qualifications. Assuredly his reply would be directly to this effect. If you were now fitted to be an accepted chela, you would of yourself know how, where, and to whom to apply. For the becoming a chela in reality consists in the evolution or development of certain spiritual principles latent in every man, and in great measure unknown to your present consciousness. Until these principles are to some degree consciously evolved by you, you are not in practical possession of the means of acquiring the first rudiments of that knowledge which now seems to you so desirable. Whether it is desired by your mind or by your heart is still another important question, not to be solved by anyone who has not yet the clue to self. It is true that these qualities can be developed, or forced, by the aid of an adept. And most applicants for chelaship are actuated by a desire to receive instructions directly from the masters. They do not ask themselves what they have done to merit a privilege so rare. Nor do they consider that, all adepts being servants of the law of karma, it must follow that, did the applicant now merit their visible aid, he would already possess it and could not be in search of it. The indications of the fulfillment of the law are, in fact, the partial unfolding of those faculties above referred to. You must then, reach a point other than that where you now stand, before you can even ask to be taken as a chela on probation. All candidates enter the unseen lodge in this manner, and it is governed by laws containing within themselves their own fulfillment and not requiring any officers whatever. Nor must you imagine that such a probationer is one who works under constant and known direction of either an adept or another chela. On the contrary, he is tried and tested for at least 7 years, and perhaps many more, before the point is reached when he is either accepted, and prepared for the first of a series of initiations often covering several incarnations, or rejected. And this rejection is not by any body of men just as they incline, but is the natural rejection by nature. The probationer may or may not hear from his teacher during this preliminary period, more often he does not hear. He may be finally rejected and not know it, just as some men have been on probation and have not known it until they suddenly found themselves accepted. Such men are those self-developed persons who have reached that point in the natural order after many incarnations, where their expanded faculties have entitled them to an entrance into the hall of learning or the spiritual lodge beyond. And all I say of men applies equally to women. When anyone is regularly accepted as a chela on probation, the first and only order he receives, for the present, is to work unselfishly for humanity, sometimes aiding and aided by some older chela, while striving to get rid of the strength of the personal idea. The ways of doing this are left to his own intuition entirely, inasmuch as the object is to develop that intuition and to bring him to self-knowledge. It is his having these powers in some degree that leads to his acceptance as a probationer, so that it is more than probable that you have them not yet save as latent possibilities. In order to have in his turn any title to help, he must work for others, but that must not be his motive for working. He who does not feel irresistibly impelled to serve the race, whether he himself fails or not, is bound fast by his own personality and cannot progress until he has learned that the race is himself and not that body which he now occupies. The ground of this necessity for a pure motive was recently stated in Lucifer to be that unless the intention is entirely unalloyed, the spiritual will transform itself into the psychic, act on the astral plane, and dire results may be produced by it. The powers and forces of animal nature can be equally used by the selfish and revengeful as by the unselfish and all-forgiving. The powers and forces of spirit lend themselves only to the perfectly pure in heart. It may be stated, however, that even those natural forces cannot be discovered by any man who has not obtained the power of getting rid of his personality in some degree. That an emotional desire to help others does not imply this freedom from personality may be seen by the fact that, if you were now perfected in unselfishness in the real sense, you would have a conscious existence separate from that of the body and would be able to quit the body at will. In other words, to be free from all sense of self is to be an adept, for the limitations of self inhibit progress. Hear also the words of the Master, taken from Sinet's The Occult World. Perhaps you will better appreciate our meaning when told that in our view the highest aspirations for the welfare of humanity become tainted with selfishness if, in the mind of the philanthropist, there lurks the shadow of a desire for self-benefit or a tendency to do injustice, even when these exist unconsciously to himself. While setting forth these facts, as well as the dangers and difficulties, both those set ones appointed by the laws of the lodge and the more innumerable ones adjudged by karma and hastened by the efforts of the neophyte, it should also be stated that the Master's desire to deter no man from entering the path. They are well aware, however, from the repeated trials and records of centuries, and from their knowledge of our racial difficulties, how few are the persons who have any clue to their own real nature, which is the foe they attempt to conquer the moment they become pupils of the occult. Hence they endeavor, so far as karma permits, to hold unfit individuals back from rash ventures, the results of which would recoil upon their unbalanced lives and drive them to despair. The powers of evil, inadequately defied by the ignorant man, revenge themselves upon him as well as upon his friends, and not upon those who are above their reach. Although these powers are not hideous objective shapes coming in tangible ways, they are none the less real and dangerous. Their descent in such instances cannot be prevented, it is karma. To lose all sense of self then, implies the loss of all that ordinary men most value in themselves. It therefore behooves you to seriously consider these points. First, what is your motive in desiring to be a chela? You think that motive is well known to you, whereas it is hidden deep within you, and by that hidden motive you will be judged. It has flared up from unseen regions upon men sure of themselves, has belched out in some lurid thought or deed of which they esteemed themselves incapable, and has overthrown their life or reason. Therefore test yourself ere karma tests you. Second, what the place and duties of a true neophyte are. When you have seriously considered both for 21 days, you may, if your desire remains firm, take a certain course open to you. It is this. Although you do not now know where you can offer yourself to masters themselves as a chela on probation, yet, in forming that desire in your heart and in reaffirming it, if you do, after due consideration of these points, you have then to some extent called upon the law, and it is within your power to constitute yourself a disciple, so far as in you lies, through the purity of your motive and effort if both are sufficiently sustained. No one can fix a period when this effort will bear fruit, and if your patience and faith are not strong enough to bear you through an unlimited, so far as you know, period of unselfish work for humanity, you had better resign your present fancy, for it is then no more than that. But if otherwise, you are to work for the spiritual enlightenment of humanity in and through the Theosophical Society, which much needs such laborers, and in all other modes and planes as you best can, remembering the word of masters, he who does what he can and all that he can, and all that he knows how to do, does enough for us. This task includes that of divesting yourself of all personality through interior effort, because that work, if done in the right spirit, is even more important to the race than any outward work we can do. Living as you now are, on the outward plane chiefly, your work is due there and is to be done there until your growth shall fit you to pass away from it altogether. In following this course you work towards a fixed point under observation, as is, indeed, the whole theosophic body, which is now, as a body, a chela of masters, but specialized from other members in the sense that your definite aim and trust are understood and taken into consideration by the unseen founders and the law. The Theosophical Society then stands to you, for the time being, as any older Chelamite who was appointed for you to aid and to work under. You are not, understand, a Chela on probation, since no one without authority can confer or announce such a privilege. But if you succeed in lifting yourself and others spiritually, it will be known, no matter what the external silence may seem to be, and you will receive your full dues from those who are honest debtors and ministers of the just and perfect law. You must be ready to work, to wait, and to aspire in silence, just as all do who have fixed their eyes on this goal. Remember that your truest advisor is to be found, and constantly sought, within yourself. Only by experience can you learn to know its voice from that of natural instinct or mere logic, and strengthen this power, by virtue of which the masters have become what they are. Your choice or rejection of this course is the first test of yourself. Others will follow, whether you are aware of them or not, for the first and only right of the neophyte is to be tried. Hence silence and sorrow follow his acceptance instead of the offer of prompt aid for which he looks. Yet even that shall not be wanting, those trials and reverses will come only from the law to which you have appealed. End article from the Path. J.N. End editor's note. Letter 15. Dear Jasper. I gave your letter to a distressed soul. She returned thanks, saying it was a cooling draught to one athirst. The thanks of course are yours. Now this lady says it was refreshment to the weary, that letter. True, or she would not say it. But it was not so to me nor to you. We needed it not. But she illustrates a certain state of progress. She is not yet where we are, but which is happier? She is happier, but poorer in hope. We are not all too happy, but are rich in hope, knowing the prize at the end of time, and not deterred by the clouds, the storms, the miasms and dreadful beasts of prey that line the road. Let us then, at the very outset, wash out of our souls all desire for reward, all hope that we may attain. For so long as we thus hope and desire, we shall be separated from the self. If in the self all things are, then we cannot wish to be something which we can only compass by excluding something else. So being beyond this lady so grateful, we find that everything we meet on this illusory plane of existence is a lure that in one way or another has power to draw us out of our path. That is the point we are at, and we may call it the point where lures of Maya have omnipresent power. Therefore we must beware of the illusions of matter. Before we got to this stage we knew well the fateful lure, the dazzling mirror of the elemental self, here and there in well-defined places, and entrenched as it was, so to say, in strongly marked defenses. Those we assaulted, and that was what it desired. For it did think that it then had no need to exercise the enchantment which is hard because so subtle, and so distributed here and there that we find no citadels to take, no battalions in array. But now our dearest friends are unconsciously in league with the deceptive in nature. How strongly do I realize the dejection of Arjuna as he let his bow drop from his hand and sat down on his chariot in despair. But he had a sure spot to rest upon. He used his own. He had Krishna near, and he might fight on. So in passing along those stages where the grateful lady and others are, we may perhaps have found one spot we may call our own and possess no other qualification for the task. That spot is enough. It is our belief in the self, in masters. It is the little flame of intuition we have allowed to burn, that we have fostered with care. Then come these dreadful lures. They are, in fact, but mere carcasses, shells of monsters from past existences, offering themselves that we may give them life to terrify us as soon as we have entered them either by fear or love. No matter which way we enter, whether by attachment or by repugnant horror, it is all one. They are in one case vivified by a lover, in the other by a slave who would be free but cannot. Here it is the lure of enjoyment of natural pleasures, growing out of life's physical basis, there it is self-praise, anger, vanity, what not. Even these beautiful hills and river, they mock one, for they live on untrammeled. Perhaps they do not speak to us because they know the superiority of silence. They laugh with each other at us in the night, amused at the wild struggle of this petty man who would pull the sky down. Ach! God of heaven! And all the sucklings of theosophy wish that some great, well-diplomed adept would come and open the secret box, but they do not imagine that other students have stepped on the spikes that defend the entrance to the way that leads to the gate of the path. But we will not blame them, nor yet wish for the things, the special lots, that some of them have abstracted, because now that we know the dreadful power that despair and doubt and violated conscience have, we prefer to prepare wisely and carefully, and not rush in like fools where angels do not pass uninvited. But, companion, I remind you of the power of the lure. This path passes along under a sky and in a clime where every weed grows a yard in the night. It has no discrimination. Thus even after weeks or months of devotion, or years of work, we are surprised at small seeds of vanity or any other thing which would be easily conquered in other years of inattentive life, but which seem now to arise as if helped by some damnable intelligence. This great power of self-illusion is strong enough to create a roaring torrent or a mountain of ice between us and our masters. In respect to the question of sex, it is, as you know, given much prominence by both women and men to the detriment of the one sex or the other, or of any supposed sex. There are those who say that the female sex is not to be thought of in the spirit, that all is male. Others say the same for the female. Now both are wrong. In the true there is no sex, and when I said there all men are women and all women are men, I was only using rhetoric to accentuate the idea that neither one nor the other was predominant, but that the two were coalesced, so to say, into one. In the same way you might say, men are animals there and vice versa. Mind, this is in regard to spirit, and not in regard to the psychical states. For in the psychical states there are still distinctions, as the psychical, though higher than the material, is not as high as spirit, for it still partakes of matter. For in the spirit or Atma all experiences of all forms of life and death are found at once, and he who is one with the Atma knows the whole manifested universe at once. I have spoken of this condition before as the Turiya or fourth state. When I say that the female principle represents matter, I do not mean women, for they in any one or more cases may be full of the masculine principle, and vice versa. Matter is illusionary and vain, and so the female element is illusionary and vain, as well as tending to the established order. Note: through its negative or passive quality. JN, end note. So in the Kabbalah it is said that the woman is a wall about the man. A balance is necessary, and that balance is found in women, or the woman element. You can easily see that the general tendency of women is to keep things as they are and not to have change. Woman, not here and there women, has never been the pioneer in great reforms. Of course many single individual women have been, but the tendency of the great mass of the women has always been to keep things as they are until the men have brought about the great change. This is why women always support any established religion, no matter what, Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, or Brahmin. The Buddhist women are as much believers in their religion and adverse from changing it as are their Christian sisters opposed in the mass to changing theirs. Now as to telling which element predominates in any single person, it is hard to give a general test rule. But perhaps it might be found in whether a person is given to abstract or concrete thought, and similarly whether given to mere superficial things or to deep fundamental matters. But you must work that out, I think, for yourself. Of course in the spiritual life no organ disappears, but we must find out what would be the mode of operation of any organ in its spiritual counterpart. As I understand, the spiritual counterparts of the organs are powers, and not organs, as the eye is the power to see, the ear the power to hear, and so on. The generative organs would then become the creative power and perhaps the will. You must not suppose that in the spirit life the organs are reproduced as we see them. One instance will suffice. One may see pictures in the astral light through the back of the head or the stomach. In neither place is there any eye, yet we see. It must be by the power of seeing, which in the material body needs the specialized place or specializing organ known as the eye. We hear often through the head without the aid of the auricular apparatus, which shows us that there is the power of hearing and of transmitting and receiving sounds without the aid of an external ear or its inside cerebral apparatus. So of course all these things survive in that way. Any other view is grossly material, leading to a deification of this unreal body, which is only an image of the reality, and a poor one at that. In thinking over these matters, you ought always to keep in mind the three plain distinctions of physical, psychical, and spiritual, always remembering that the last includes the other two. All the astral things are of the psychical nature, which is partly material and therefore very deceptive. But all are necessary, for they are, they exist. The deity is subject to this law, or rather it is the law of the deity. The deity desires experience or self-knowledge, which is only to be attained by stepping, so to say, aside from self. So the deity produces the manifested universes consisting of matter, psychical nature, and spirit. In the spirit alone resides the great consciousness of the whole, and so it goes on ever producing and drawing into itself, accumulating such vast and enormous experiences that the pen falls down at the thought. How can that be put into language? It is impossible, for we at once are met with the thought that the deity must know all at all times. Yet there is a vastness and an awe-inspiring influence in this thought of the day and night of Brahman. It is a thing to be thought over in the secret recesses of the heart, and not for discussion. It is the all. And now, my brother, for the present I leave you. May your restored health enable you to do more work for the world. I salute you, my brother, and wish you to reach the terrace of enlightenment. Z.